This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank. Focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Investors know they're taking a risk getting into the markets. All kinds of things can go wrong, including companies that aren't, well, always straight with you. If something goes wrong, you could sue, but today that got harder to do. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. AngiesList.com. The Marketplace Health Desk is supported by the Commonwealth Fund, a private foundation working toward a high-performance health system. On the web at commonwealthfund.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Thursday, the 21st of June. If you're a corporate executive, it's been a good year for Supreme Court decisions. If you're an investor, not so much. The High Court unveiled a decision today in a case called Tell Labs versus Macor. The 8-1 ruling will make it a bit more difficult for angry investors to bring class action lawsuits, alleging that they've been ripped off by companies committing securities fraud. Marketplace's Stephen Henn explains.
It wasn't that long ago that WorldCom, Enron, and Adelphia were making front page news with their elaborate accounting frauds and spectacular bankruptcies. But today, the Supreme Court made it a bit tougher for investors who believe they've been victimized by corporate accounting shenanigans to get their cases to trial. Before today's ruling, all you had to do to get a class action heard in some parts of the country was succeed in
connecting the dots between alleged fact and alleged fraud in a way that was plausible.
Eric Talley is a law professor at UC Berkeley.
This opinion says that's not quite right.
Basically, after today, in order to get a case to trial, investors will have to convince a judge that their story about how a fraud took place seems at least as cogent and convincing as any excuses the company's executives can come up with.
I think we will see more cases being thrown out as a result of this decision.
Carol Gillum is the president of the National Association of Consumer and Shareholder Attorneys. She says the court's most conservative justices wanted to make it even tougher to get these suits heard.
It will be more difficult, make no mistake about that.
For companies and their executives, though, this is good news. Robin Conrad at the National Chamber Litigation Center says these lawsuits are tremendously expensive for firms.
They incur huge discovery costs. They allow plaintiffs to go on major fishing expeditions.
Conrad says today's decision could save innocent companies and their investors millions. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Almost 2 years and more than $1 billion later, parts of New Orleans are still vulnerable to floods that could wipe out large swaths of progress made since Hurricane Katrina. The Army Corps of Engineers has released a report and maps showing that while some neighborhoods are benefiting from stronger levees and pumps, others, including the embattled Lower Ninth Ward, could again find themselves underwater. Lieutenant Colonel David Berzek is a project manager with the Army Corps and has been talking to residents about who's at risk.
typical first question was, are we safer? And the model can show, the model will definitely show that we're in the areas where the work has been completed, we have reduced the level of risk.
Unfortunately for some homeowners, the maps are a bit tardy. They've already started building in areas now shown to face potential flooding despite the ongoing repair efforts. And insurance companies are likely to use the report to help determine coverage and premiums. By the time I'm finished saying the word nanotechnology, your hair will have grown about 10 nanometers. These nanomaterials may be small, but their use in products and industry just gets bigger. But no one's really keeping tabs on whether they'll end up a giant health or environmental risk. One green group is joining with a chemical company to lay down some nano guidelines, presumably in teeny tiny print, to evaluate this growing sector. Janet Babin reports from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
Maybe you've never heard of a nanoparticle and doubt you've ever been near one. But if you've brushed on face powder, rubbed on sunscreen, or swung a golf club, you've probably benefited from nano. Because they're so tiny, they can do things other materials can't, like make creams easier to blend into skin or clubs stronger. But that's also the reason they can be dangerous. Some studies suggest nanoparticles can damage lung and brain tissue. Andrew Maynard is with the Wilson Center Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies.
In some cases, it appears that they can actually enter cells or enter parts of the body or even parts of the environment that larger particles can't do.
So what happens if that nano silver particle were to escape into the local stream? Regulation of that scenario is spotty at best. Most industries simply self-regulate. Now, Environmental Defense and DuPont have issued guidelines. First, they recommend companies describe how they'll use a material. Scott Walsh is with Environmental Defense.
The next step, you actually profile the entire life cycle of the material. So how it's developed as a material, how it's incorporated into a product, how that product is used, and what happens to that product after it's used.
But to some activists, having DuPont in the mix is like putting the coyote in charge of the house cat. Environmental attorney George Kimbrell.
They don't have the best history as far as environmental and human health impacts go.
Kimbrell says it's federal agencies entrusted with protecting human and environmental health that should develop nano guidelines. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
And from the nano question, we turn to a more macro environmental issue. The EPA announced new recommendations today on tightening limits on ground-level ozone. Translation, smog. Federal smog standards haven't budged since 1997, and the government says current limits don't adequately protect the public health. So we can all breathe easier, right? Well, as Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, the agency's decision was about as clear as a summer day here in Los Angeles.
The EPA's proposal would tighten smog standards as much as 20% over the next few decades, but it's not as strict as the standard recommended by the EPA's independent panel of scientific advisors, and the agency will still solicit comments later this year on alternatives, including keeping the status quo.
That's an outrageous idea.
Frank O'Donnell at Clean Air Watch says the EPA's decision sends mixed signals. He believes the agency is waffling because of political pressure.
We know that lobbyists for car companies, oil companies, electric power companies, and chemical companies have all been to the White House in the last several weeks, and they've all said, slow the EPA down.
Health advocates say new studies show smog can lead to lung damage, heart disease, even premature death. But industry groups argue many states and counties can't meet current standards, let alone tougher ones. Bill Kovacs is with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Some of the standards that EPA is imposing, especially the most restrictive standard, would literally put the entire United States in nonattainment. And once that happens, they have killed the ability of local communities in nonattainment to do economic development.
Counties that fail to meet federal smog standards do risk a loss of federal highway funds. Industry also claims stricter limits will cost over $100 billion. But the Supreme Court ruled in 2001 the EPA doesn't have to consider industry costs when setting ozone limits. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Tickets for four to soccer's 2010 World Cup? Oh, I don't know, $1,000? Airfare to South Africa? Let's say $6,000. Losing the sponsorship rights for the next two World Cup tournaments? Well, MasterCard did put a price on that, $90 million. For $90 million, MasterCard agreed to drop its lawsuit against soccer's ruling body, FIFA. The card company balked when FIFA announced last year that it was tapping Visa International for the tournaments in 2010 and 2014 after 16 years with MasterCard. So much for priceless. On Wall Street, a rebound thanks to semiconductors. Details when we do the numbers. The private equity industry got an earful in London yesterday from lawmakers there who think they don't pay enough tax. Well, they're not the only ones feeling the heat in Europe. Other largely unregulated investor groups, like hedge funds, are also drawing fire. One German politician called them locusts. He said some of the more active funds will sell a company or a currency short just to rip it to pieces. But one London-based hedge fund has largely escaped criticism, despite its fearsome reputation. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more from the British capital.
What can you say about an aggressive hedge fund which calls itself the Children's Investment Fund and puts a percentage of its earnings into charitable works?
I think it makes wonderful sense as a marketing ploy.
That's the sceptical response from economist Andrew Hilton. Others, like Paul Palmer of the Cass Business School, are more trusting.
I don't think it is a marketing ploy. It'd be very hard to see how a hedge fund would be claiming that somehow it's winning competitive advantage by giving some of its funds away.
The Children's Investment Fund, or TCI, was set up 3 years ago. It now has around $7 billion under management. From the outset, the managers donated at least a half of 1% of the fund each year to help poor and sick kids in the developing world. Good for them, says Palmer.
At least these people are doing something, and although there's a cynical view out there, at least they are doing something rather than just thinking about it or talking about it.
But TCI has benefited from the charity. Hedge funds, like their private equity cousins, are often unpopular for shaking up and breaking up companies. And yet the TCI has enjoyed a better press than some of its rivals, says Andrew Hilton.
It's a little bit difficult to kind of knock something that has at its foundation a commitment to charity, even though in fact it's just as aggressive, just as predatory as any of its competitors.
TCI is pushy, to say the least. It led the attack on the Dutch bank ABN AMRO, triggering a massive transatlantic battle. In a separate move, the fund forced the head of the German stock exchange to quit. But, claims Norma Cohen of the Financial Times, the fund's managers are not just cold-blooded financial predators.
One of the things that I think they were most proud of is having funded the development of antiretroviral drugs that are small enough to be taken by children.
The fund has raised well over $100 million for children with AIDS in Africa and India. Cohen believes that the hedge fund does profit from the charity, but in an unexpected way.
It has enabled them to attract very talented fund managers who want to feel that they are, you know, at the same time they're making money for clients, that they're also raising money for a good purpose.
Both the hedge fund and the charitable foundation refuse to talk about their work. Not surprising, says Cohen.
That is not uncommon among hedge funds who do not advertise to the public, do not collect funds from the public.
But critics of hedge funds say this lack of transparency is the problem. More funds are becoming more activist, wielding huge power, without the authorities knowing too much about them. For all its good works, even the Children's Investment Fund is facing calls for tighter regulation and more disclosure. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
As we mentioned earlier, the Supreme Court issued a ruling today that makes it tougher for investors to go after companies accused of fraud. Well, next week, the court may decide whether to hear another case involving Enron shareholders. They're trying to sue the banks that help the energy company work its numbers magic. Opponents of the suit, including President Bush, argue the federal government should be solely responsible for going after the banks. Commentator Jamie Court says the private market provides the best path to justice.
Okay, let's say you've been swindled. Who are you going to trust to get your money back? Uncle Sam or private plaintiff's attorneys? Well, President Bush said he would count on SEC attorneys to recover Enron shareholders' dough. That's why the White House isn't asking the Supreme Court to let victims of stock fraud at Enron or any other company sue the bankers that hid the sham transactions. Headline, Bush to Nation, Government Does Better Job Than Private Enterprise System. Well, the SEC regulators who deal with this every day want the Supremes to let Enron victims directly sue Enron bankers. Why? Government lawyers know the most efficient way for swindled shareholders to get their money back is through private litigation, not government lawsuits. Just look at the Enron recovery. Total SEC fines collected from Enron and its bankers? Less than $500 million, little more than 1% of the $40 billion loss. By contrast, private plaintiff's attorneys have settled more than $7 billion in civil cases from a handful of banks, including J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and Citigroup. More banks will pay if the Supreme Court decision is in favor of shareholders after a lower court blocked their right to sue bankers. The problem in relying on government lawyers is they don't make any money off shareholder lawsuits, and they might want to work for those banks in the end, so why tick them off? Private lawyers can get a nice percentage of the take. Government prosecutors also are often more interested in making a name by jailing swindlers rather than returning dollars to the swindled. I know the Supreme Court is never swayed by ideology. That's why I hope in this case it declares the free market the fairest and most efficient way for shareholders to get their due.
Jamie Cord is president of the Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights. What do you think? Tell us at marketplace.org. Click on contact. Coming up, bring him back the soul.
The music cuts across all kinds of boundaries. You know, Kanye West and Jay-Z have Sample Stax Records. It's used constantly in movies and television.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks gained some ground on Wall Street today as investors shook off worries about rising interest rates. The Dow rose 56 points, 0.4%, to close at 13,545. The Nasdaq ticked up 17 points, 0.6%, to 2,616. The S&P rose 9 points, 0.6%, to 1,522. Shares of Oakley, the sunglass maker, rose nearly 13% on news that an Italian eyewear company will buy it. It's paying $2.1 billion, and that's all cash. Goldman Sachs Real Estate Group announced it will buy Equity Inns for $1.25 billion. Shares of the hotel operator shot up 17%. Chipmaker AMD was up about 8% after the company was upgraded by some analysts. And in the bond market, bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury rose to 5.19%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the House Foreign Affairs Committee discusses the future of NATO. Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa hosts the annual meeting of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And the iconic Bionic Woman celebrates her birthday. Actress Lindsay Wagner will be 58. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund in for Kai Rizdahl. 35 years ago this weekend, June 23, 1972, Title IX was enacted. It mandated, among other things, that any school receiving federal money provide equal opportunities for men and women. In athletics, it's meant many things to many people. More money and opportunity for women athletes, less money and opportunity, critics say, for the guys. Here to look back on the impact of Title IX with us is our Business of Sports commentator, Diana Nyad. Good to see you again, Diana.
Thanks so much. What's going on?
Well, you know, we've got this 35th anniversary of Title IX coming up this weekend. Obviously, a cause near and dear to our hearts as women and to your heart as a female athlete. Tell me, has it worked?
I think overall it has. I dare say even some of the lawyers who have argued Title IX cases against the women would say that it was needed. I mean, Tess, I graduated high school in the late 60s. Mm-hmm. I was a world champion. Look at Billie Jean King. She was a Wimbledon champion by the time she graduated high school. There wasn't a drop, not a dollar, of college scholarship money for us in those days. So if you wanted to go to college and still play sports, you were on your own. You had to become part of a men's team or go to the local, you know, a community and play there. Before Title IX, before 1972, there were about 300,000 girls playing high school sports around this country. Now there are 3 million. So we have to applaud that.
But have we been able to find a balance there? Because, you know, the ongoing debate is whether it's fair to have a school cut wrestling or lacrosse or some other men's sport in order to make room for women's sports under the so-called proportionality rule.
There are two key issues. One is what you're bringing up now, proportionality. There are more females going to college today than men. Nationwide, it's about 57% to 43%. So if your population is 57% female and you're forced by Title IX to allocate 57% of your sports budget to women, but women don't show up.
Right.
They're not as interested as boys still to play. Now, the Title IX advocates will say, well, they'll get interested. Give them the opportunity, and they'll show up. Build the field, and they shall come. but so far, it is proving out that there are a number of schools that can't fill their rosters, you know, even though they've made the women's teams and the recruiting and the coaching and the travel funds available. So honestly, even as a feminist and a big Title IX proponent, I can say that proportionality hasn't been exactly a just cause in a lot of schools. And I said there are two issues. Mm-hmm. The other one's football.
Yeah, football. You know, this is the sport that really makes the equation hard to figure out because it's so far beyond any other sport. You know, you've got enormous layouts of money. You've got huge numbers of athletes involved. And there's just no comparison anywhere else.
Yeah, well, there are groups like the Women's Sports Foundation, you know, which is Billie Jean King's foundation for women's advocacy in sports.
And full disclosure, we should mention you're on the board there.
Yes, yes. And there are many other groups, too, like the Women's Sports Foundation, who will say that when a men's wrestling team is dropped, men's tennis team, gymnastics team, mm-hmm. it has nothing to do with Title IX. It has to do with football. The resources that have to go into football, even though they bring in so much revenue, but then when the revenue comes in, it goes
right back out.
It goes right back into football. So it has been suggested by legislators and all kinds of other advocacy people on both sides of this issue since way back, since Title IX first came into being in the early 70s, that football just be taken out of the Title IX equation. And so if football just makes its own revenue, pays its own way, and then the rest of the pie is divided up equally by the genders, men's and women's basketball and fencing and wrestling and tennis and gymnastics and swimming and all of it, if we got football out of there, let them take care of themselves, I think then we would probably have the most fair situation I can personally think of.
Diana Nyad is our Business of Sports commentator. Thanks so much for coming in. Great to talk about this with you.
Right on, Tess.
If you're in the mood for a soul version of the classic Happy Birthday, head to the Orpheum Theater on Beale Street in Memphis tomorrow. Some of the most famous soul artists of the 60s and 70s will gather on stage to celebrate 50 years of the Stax record label. Stax was home to some of the biggest soul and R&B talent in the country. It boasted such legends as Otis Redding, Isaac Hayes, and Booker T and the MGs before going bankrupt in the mid-70s. Now, two buyouts and half a century later, Trey Kay reports the label's about to get another spin.
Even if you've never bought a soul record or listened much to 60s music, chances are you've heard something from the Stax label. Back in the 60s and 70s, Stax was home to some of the most famous names in soul and R&B. I'm a soul man. The golden days at Stax lasted about 20 years, but in 1975, the company ran out of money and went belly up. In 2004, the Concord Music Group bought the entire Stax catalog and the rights to use the Stax brand. Robert Smith is marketing executive for Concord. He says the Stax catalog is valuable because it appeals to baby boomers and younger generations.
The Stax catalog and Stax Records is part of that rich heritage of soul music in America. It has some of the greatest pop music ever recorded. The music cuts across all kinds of boundaries. You know, Kanye West and Jay-Z sample Stax Records. It's used constantly in movies and television. And kids today hear a lot of Stax.
Concord's plan for Stax isn't just about peddling oldies. Starting this summer, Concord will bring the Stax label out of mothballs. Jeff Mayfield is the director of charts for Billboard magazine. He says the Stax label will be a home for all sorts of soul acts. It'll include new musicians as well as established acts. They're even releasing a new album by Stax veteran Isaac Hayes, whose single, The Theme from Shaft, is still a hit today.
Can you dig it?
I would say that considering the track record of the Concord folks, they're making an astute move here.
Mayfield says that record sales fell 16% in 2006. The only music genre to show any kind of growth was R&B and soul. Mayfield says there's a gap in the R&B market that Concord could fill with music from a new Stax label. The new Stax won't just win Concord more record sales. Mayfield says it'll give the company an edge with musicians as well.
Stax gives Concord a logo that has heritage. It could mean a little bit more to the consumer. And, you know, it could even mean something to certain artists as well. You know, sometimes record companies keep relationships with heritage artists just because that might help them sign the next cool guy. Oh, I want to be with a label that has Bob Dylan, or I want to be with a label that has Tom Petty.
It might work, but there are plenty of other labels out there. And the golden age of Stax ended more than 30 years ago. Still, Concord's Robert Smith says the mystique of the Stax label will still be a powerful lure to soul musicians.
You can't recreate the past, but what you can do is carry forward the tradition and the approach and the heritage that that music represented. The relaunch of Stax Records is creating a great home for soul music.
Concord will roll out the first Stax albums by new artists in late July. The company's even dusting off the old Stax logo, the image of two fingers snapping. It hopes it'll be a beacon to soul music mavens all over the world. In New York, I'm Trey Kay for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, the days of shelling out big bucks for eggs advertising omega-3 fatty acids are so over. The Center for Science and the Public Interest says the designer eggs, which can cost double what's charged for a standard carton, aren't all they're, wait for it, cracked up to be. They have low levels of omega-3s, and like other eggs, they're high in saturated fat and cholesterol. On the sunny side, you can still get all the omega-3 you need from fish. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow spiked 57 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ ticked up 17 points, 0.6%. And the S&P rose 9 points, also 0.6% there. Our editors include John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the show, shutting down much-needed schools for pregnant teens.
I was planning to actually go back to Martha Nelson. Now that Martha Nelson is supposed to be closing, I don't know where I'm going to go. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know anything.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.